Before Hillary Clinton, there were Victoria Woodhull, Republican Senator Margaret Chase Smith, and Democratic Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm. In her new book, The Highest Glass Ceiling: Women's Quest for the American Presidency, historian Ellen Fitzpatrick examines the surprisingly long history of women's engagement in presidential politics and demonstrates that, though the obscurity of these women's stories today mirrors the ridicule, scorn, and disregard they often endured in their own time, it is thanks to their efforts that a woman president is now inevitable. Again, the title of the book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, and we welcome Ellen Fitzpatrick to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what brought you to this subject of looking at the woman's quest for the presidency?
Well, it seemed to me that it was likely that there would be potentially a woman running for president in 2016, and I was struck by the fact of how little history people seem to know, myself included, about those who had run for the presidency in the past. There have been some 200 women over the course of American history who were either nominated for or appeared on a ballot for the presidency, and most of them are pretty much lost to history. So it seemed to me to be a worthy project to bring some of this back to light.
What is the fact that they have been lost to history say overall about the issues of electing a woman president?
Well, they face some very great obstacles, obviously. And, you know, as is true for most failed male presidential candidates, they too are largely lost to history, and there have been a lot of them. But the fact that there has been no woman ever elected to the American presidency, it seemed to me, was a compelling point that made it worth trying to explore what some of the obstacles were that they had faced. And in the end, I decided to focus on three candidates whose campaigns really crystallize some of the challenges that women have faced in the past when they have sought the highest electoral office in the land.
Victoria Woodhull, Senator Margaret Chase Smith, and Democratic Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm. Give us a sense of what these women have in common and how they were remarkable in their own right.
Well, they were, starting with your second point, all three quite remarkable women who showed a tremendous amount of courage in running for the presidency at three different historical moments, each one of which in some ways provided an opening for their campaign, but also repeated many of these difficulties that women candidates have faced and continue to face today. In the case of Victoria Woodhull, she emerged during Reconstruction after the Civil War when there was a lively debate about the whole nature of freedom and democracy in American society, new constitutional amendments being passed to confer political rights on African Americans. And she thought that this was a time to address women's political inequality and had the insight that if she presented herself as a candidate, people might be able to rally around the cause in a more concrete way than in the philosophical way that other women suffragists were trying to advance. So she comes out of that context. In the case of Margaret Chase Smith, who ran in 1964, she's also emerging at a moment when the modern women's movement is beginning to take form. There was some progress in the early 1960s. And she thought that given her long record in Congress, and both the House and the Senate, greatly revered woman in American public life, that she was a suitable candidate and surfaced in that context. And then finally, Chisholm comes forward in 1972 when the women's liberation movement is really in full flower and presents herself as the first African-American woman to seek the nomination of a major political party running on the Democratic ticket in the Democratic primary.
You do discuss in the book four components that you regard as crucial to a serious presidential run: money, media, party support, and of course, constituents.
Yes.
give us a sense of why those four are so important, and then we'll talk about how they impacted each of these three women.
Well, in the case of money, it's ironic that this has become a sort of a millstone around Hillary Clinton's neck these days, because it has been the single greatest obstacle for women who have sought higher office. Until Emily's List emerged, there was really very little effort to try to amass the kind of war chest that modern presidential candidates need today. And for all the three women that I look at, they predated Emily's List. So they were really trying to put together, enough money to run for the presidency at a time, at least in the case of Smith and Chisholm, when these have become extraordinarily expensive campaigns, especially in the modern period when we have mass media being such a factor. That raises the issue of media, too, of course. And in the case of Smith and Chisholm, they simply couldn't afford to run the kind of campaign ads and to use television in the way that their competitors were. Victoria Woodhull recognized that she needed sympathetic media, so she started her own newspaper. She was a very wealthy woman, a Wall Street broker, as it turned out. And so she was able to self-finance her campaign. In the case of the party support, none of them really had much support from the elites in their political parties, and that was a huge obstacle for all of them. In the case of constituents, it's interesting because, much like Hillary Clinton faces today, some women were very enthusiastic and supportive, and others were not. And even feminists, who one would have assumed would have supported these candidates, were by no means unified in their enthusiasm for these emerging female presidential candidates.
When it comes to the importance of this, why do you believe that it is important to have a woman president? And also, why so much of the rest of the world has had women leaders, of why we have been conspicuously absent on that list for so long?
Well, I would say, as would each one of these women that I profile in my book, that simply the gender of the candidate is obviously not the most salient thing. We're looking, of course, to elect the best leadership in our country that we can. And they all said, don't vote for me simply because I'm a woman, but don't vote against me because I'm a woman. So I think in terms of my own view of the matter as a citizen, it seems to me that we benefit as a country from opening the race to people of either sex who have talent and have something to offer our country, which is surely is in sore need of outstanding leadership, and to sort of deepen and enrich the pool of candidates is to everybody's benefit. So that, I think, is clearly the most important thing. So why eliminate 50% of the possibilities by discriminating essentially against women candidates or seeing them as somehow unworthy? On your second point about other nations, that's a very interesting question that often comes up. And one of the things that's somewhat unique about the United States, not entirely, but in our case, the American presidency is combined with not only the chief executive, but is also the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And traditionally, women have been seen as not perhaps up to that job, particularly in the long period that predated the integration by sex of the military in the United States. So I think that this strong association between men and military service, and of course the historical record thereof, contributed to some bias against women as potential presidents.
In your chronology and looking at these women, does one learn from the other? Do you see a progression at all so we get to that point?
I wish I could tell you that it's a story about, incremental progress. And in some ways it is, but it's also a story about repetition. I think the progress is most evident when we get to 1972 and Shirley Chisholm is able to benefit from changes in the rules in both the Democratic and Republican parties after 1968, which opened them up more to the representation of women and minorities, in particular in the Democratic Party after the disastrous 68 election. There was an effort to try to ensure that there would be more diverse state delegations. And Chisholm was able to capitalize on that and actually came to the convention. She only had about 150 delegates, but prior to Hillary Clinton in 2008, that was the most that any woman presidential candidate had been able to amass. So that really was a breakthrough moment, and it made a big difference, and it helped to pave the way to the election of our first African-American president as well. On the other hand, the kinds of prejudices that they have faced and doubts, there is a kind of loop here where we're seeing the repetition of some of the same old themes.
The name of the book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. The book is published by Harvard. Ellen Fitzpatrick is professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. Ellen, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Highest Glass Ceiling. It's published by Harvard. Ellen Fitzpatrick is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.